So I have decided that since we've been doing constraint satisfaction problems, which are close enough to propositional logic, we would start doing logic, propositional logic first, instead of planning. And so, and of course, there is no better way to introduce logic than Python logic. So you just saw Python logic. That and the fact that I just got up at 1:30 your time in Rhode Island and took a flight and got here about 10 minutes back, so I could actually just let you watch Holy Grail and go to sleep in the back of the class myself. That also looked like a good idea, but what? okay, so anyway, so I think of all the things in this, the part that I really like is what also floats on water, and John Cleese's character says, small rocks. That I like. That I really like. Yeah, if you're, you know, putting, this is sort of like, for sufficiently large values of 1, 1 plus 1 is equal to 3. You just have to have a really big one. This is actually from last class. We just, so that you can kind of remember what we were doing last time, we were looking at the phase transition phenomenon. Do people remember what it was? The idea that if you are considering 3-sat problems, which is a sort of a constraint satisfaction problem with basically Boolean variables, okay, where all the classes are 3RE. Now, in saying that, there's actually an interesting point that's being made. Again, we'll go through proposition logic more slowly in a minute, but we don't have to pretend that none of us know propositional logic. All of you know it already. You've seen this in many different places. So, in general, one of the interesting things is any propositional logic statement of this form, let's say P and Q implies R, can ultimately be written in a general form, which is basically what's called clauses. Okay, and a clause in this particular case, this can get simplified as not of P and Q R. Okay, you all know this, right? P implies Q is equivalent to not of P or Q. Okay. And so this, when you simplify this further, if you take the negation inside, it becomes not of P or not of Q or R. And in fact, anything that you can write in propositional logic, you can basically prove to yourself by induction that ultimately they can all be made into clauses of this form. This is called the CNF form. And we will actually look at it more systematically in a minute. So we will assume that all clauses, you know, if you, to the extent you think of Boolean CSPs are nothing but sets. Okay, if you can think of Boolean CSPs as constraint satisfaction problems, the constraints correspond to these kinds of clauses, and you can think of all the clauses in this form. And constraints correspond to these kind of propositional formulas, but you can imagine that they can all be converted into this sort of CNF form. Okay. What is more interesting, in fact, when I said you can convert it into CNF form, I didn't quite say that you can convert into CNF form where the clauses will have a certain length. So in particular, had I written P and Q implies R, R, J, it's not all that hard to figure out that this would have become not P or not Q, R, 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 J. So in that case, it will have been a 4RE, a 4-length clause. But it turns out that any Boolean satisfiability problem which has clauses of length more than 4, length more than 3, can be translated into an equivalent satisfiability problem of length equal to 3 or less. Why? Partly that's because it turns out that 2-sat, where all the clauses are at most length 2, winds up being polynomial, whereas 3-sat it becomes NP-complete. And general SAT is also NP-complete. Okay, so it's not too hard to understand that there must be some way of polynomially converting a satisfiability problem with larger classes into one with three RE classes, because the overall complexity doesn't change. Okay, had I, for example, told you that there is a way of converting any satisfiability problem into a two SAT problem, polynomially convert into a two SAT problem, then you should yell. Exactly, because what's happening then is you can convert a 3 SAT or a 4 SAT problem into a 2 SAT problem, which only polynomial increase in the size. Since 2 SAT can be computed in polynomial time, then essentially you are saying everything is polynomial. But we know that if you do that, either you'll get a Turing Award for having proved P equal to NP, or, you know, more likely than not will be, you know, laughed out of the room, because most people have tried it and failed. So the point is 3 SAT is actually canonical. Remember, we talked about canonical representations in the blog last week. Satisfiability is a canonical representation. Binary CSPs are canonical representations. Another canonical representation is 3 SAT. So the interesting thing is you can look at just 3 SAT problems and see how their complexity changes. And the point we made last time was that, and by the end of the class last time we looked at this, and I'm just trying to show you once more because it's been like a couple of weeks. The point we made last time is that in fact the complexity seems to, if you consider the difficulty of solving the problem here versus the probability that the problem has a solution. Okay, and in both cases, x-axis is the number of clauses by number of propositions, which is like number of constraints by number of variables. And we talked in the last class, at the end of last class, that if this number is very small, in essence, that means what? There are very few constraints. So pretty much any assignment will wind up being a solution. And if this number is very high, that means there are too many constraints relative to the number of variables you have, and so more likely than not you won't have any solution at all. Okay, so it's not surprising at all that it would be like the probability of solution here would be 1, the probability of solution here will be close to 0. What is surprising is whether it will go slowly from 1 to 0 over a large region, or does it kind of fall. And the interesting part that we discussed last time was, in fact, it seems to fall with a pretty sharp threshold. Okay, so, you know, in this is actually the other day I just showed a hand-drawn curve, but this is actual experimental results that, you know, somebody produced, where probably that a random 3 CNF sentence with n equal to 50 symbols is satisfiable. They kept n equal to 50 and modified and varied the ratio. And you do notice that what we expected, you know, there is like a nice sharp peak. You know, the question of course is approximately where is this peak occurring? It's around 4 point something. Okay, so that was the magic ratio. And that, this is all a review of last time's thing, and in fact this is not even really important for this class, but it's fascinating all the same, that there is a whole cottage industry of sorts trying to figure out exactly where this threshold is. Exactly where this threshold is. Okay. In fact, as you can see at the top of this slide, we do know, this was actually a slide that was made like 3 years back, and I'm sure there is a better understanding right now, slightly better, I'm sure. We do know that that we are not dreaming. In fact, mathematically you can show that for these kinds of problems there will be a sharp threshold. Okay. That in itself, somebody had to write a PhD dissertation from a math department. Okay. And the second one is that experimentally it seems to be close to about 4.3. Many, many different people tried this and it seems to be around 4.3. And what's more is if you want to try and analytically pinpoint where the exact transition is, this is the way the picture is. It's cute. I just thought it's like a cottage industry of sorts where people are trying to prove where. So you know, for example, that it has to be bigger than these numbers. And you also know that it has to be smaller than these numbers. So people are successfully providing proofs you know, reducing the range in which the threshold number has to be. Okay, I think the last I pointed out to you was that around 3.26, and in this, if you can see, around 3.26, this is a lower bound. It has to be higher than that, and 4.596 is an upper bound. It has to be lower than that. And some of these proofs are actually easy enough to understand. Some are quite hard to understand. Okay, the easy proofs, I mean, especially the high bounds, these ones are easy to understand. But as you come increasingly closer, it becomes hard because it's a more painful combinatorial argument. Okay, but that's kind of cute, I thought, in terms of it's not that you're just finding something in some particular experiment, but you may be able to actually find a nice constant which should have some meaning, like, you know, pi and something like that. Okay, so that's the point. So having said all this, this whole thing is obviously related to constraint satisfaction problems, and we went from constraint satisfaction problems into satisfiability problems. And the moment we started thinking about satisfiability problems, you can already see that it's sort of close to propositional logic, because you're talking about Boolean variables with their truth and falsity values. They only have two values, so they have truth and falsity values. So in fact, the reason I actually decided to go and do propositional logic is that A, of course, we're talking about satisfiability right now, and B, it turns out that once you start thinking about propositional logic as a representation mechanism, a knowledge representation mechanism, you will see that there are, when viewed as a representation mechanism, the interesting thing, that the thing that you're most interested in is inference. So suppose I write down what all I know about my world as a bunch of propositional logic statements. Okay, what I would be interested in finding is, does this entail a new statement S200? Given all I know, is S200 true? Okay, now S200 could be a statement. Suppose if these were all made up of P, Q, R, and S propositional variables. S200 could be, is P and Q true? That could be the question. Or I can also ask, is false true? What I mean is, given what I know, can I entail false? If I can entail false, what it means is this set of clauses is inconsistent. Now, if you think about what we did in the CSP search, again, this was close to a week back, you were considering partial assignments, splitting them based on some variable value, okay? So at any point, you have a partial assignment, and either you can expand it by splitting on new variables, or you can do forward checking. Remember, you would do forward checking, which says, based on the current assignments, can I actually prove to myself that this guy is dead already? If it is dead, then I don't need to do any more search. When you were doing forward checking, it turns out that you are essentially doing a form of entailment check. Okay, and the deeper point that you would, you know, come to appreciate by the time we are done doing propositional logic along with CSPs is that there's a yin and yang in search, which is search and inference. Okay, what you try to, in trying to do search, you split. You basically take choices saying, you know, take different branches and see if any of them leads to solution. Inference tries to see if any given branch can be proved to not have any solution. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it turns out that doing inference could involve search. Doing search can involve inference. When you had a good CSP algorithm, it wound up doing not only search, it also did forward checking, which is a form of inference. There are much more interesting forms of inference that CSP algorithms can do, such as consistency, K-consistency enforcement. I had slides on that in the end of the last lecture, but I didn't talk about it. But we will talk about it once we have had a chance to understand what entailment means in propositional logic. because you can essentially think of k-consistency as doing entailment, doing inference. Okay, so there are many, many ways in which you can get into propositional logic. In fact, there's a completely different way of getting into it, which is we told ourselves in the beginning of the semester that our agents would need a language in which to write their, knowledge. Okay, some language in which they have to write their knowledge. And the question is, what would be that knowledge? What would be that language? And the simplest form of that language could be propositional logic. And then a more immediate, proximal reason to look at propositional logic, given last week's class, is that you are already looking at propositional logic in terms of just finding models. Okay. Now we will look at propositional logic in terms of entailment, and we'll see that they are very closely intertwined. Okay, finding models and doing entailment are connected. Okay. By the way, I said the word finding models. Basically, if I give you a set of clauses and I ask you, can you give me an assignment of truth falsity values to the proposition such that all clauses are satisfied? And if you give it to me, you just gave me a model. A model is any truth falsity assignment that satisfies all the clauses. So models are the solutions of the CSP. Normally in CSP, you look for any model, just find a model. That means find a solution that satisfies all the constraints. But when you are doing entailment, you'll notice that we will be reasoning over all models, which is sort of like looking for all solutions of a CSP problem. It's sort of like looking for all solutions of an 8-queens problem. Okay, so the connections are multifarious in terms of knowledge representation and search. Okay, so that's basically what models are, and you already know. So based on this discussion, you already know that we know how to find models for propositional knowledge bases. Yes, no? If I give you a bunch of clauses and I ask you find me a model, you can go and find it, right? In fact, I'll remind you that you do know at least one algorithm. This algorithm you know. We talked about it in the last class. I mean, it looks in a different direction. It's written up on a different slide here, but this is basically your min conflicts heuristic. Okay, so here is a way of finding models. Okay, so suppose let's say I have these clauses. Okay, now when I talk about these clauses, I already had this discussion saying whatever you give me, I can ultimately put them into this clausal form. Okay, so suppose I gave you these clauses, right, and I'm trying to find a model. That means truth falsity assignments or a CSP solution that will satisfy all the clauses. What can I do? I can start with a possible model. That means an interpretation. In fact, I should have called this an interpretation, okay, which is just given truth falsity values to all the variables, and then go through this loop. Okay, what this one is saying is from I equal to 1 to max flips. Max is the number of flips that you're going to do. What you would do is check the model and see the interpretation that you have in your hand and see if it satisfies all the clauses. If it does, you're done. The one that you guess is actually a solution. You're done. If not, you need to flip some things. This is called max flips because ultimately in a normal 8-queens problem, remember, if you came up with a 8-queens configuration and it didn't work, you need to change one of the queens positions at least. Otherwise, how do you go from this wrong solution to some other slightly right solution? Somebody's positions has to change. When you are in Boolean variables, it's just whatever is false, something which is false might become true, or something which is true might become false. So you think in terms of flipping variables. Okay. So, and also remember I said the neighborhood can be defined in terms of how many variables you flip, how many variables you change. The simplest is to change only one variable at a time. That's the simplest neighborhood. Okay. So in this particular search algorithm, I'm basically randomly selecting a clause from all the clauses. So here is an example. So I'm basically picking one of the clauses, and then with probability p, whichever symbol in that clause maximizes the number of satisfied clauses, that's the one I will flip. So I'm trying to figure out which variable to flip. There are many, many ways of doing that. One is to consider for every variable, flip it, and see what is the number of clauses satisfied after flip, number of clauses satisfied before flip, compute the delta, and pick the variable that has the highest delta, highest positive delta. That would be the way to do it. This one is actually, what this one is saying is, instead of looking at all the variables, just pick a clause randomly and only consider the variables that are appearing in that clause. So you sort of reduced your greediness, so that you're not considering all variables, you're only considering one clause that is definitely false right now. So somebody in that clause has to change, right? The question is, which variable should you change such that the clause, so any of the variables in that clause, if you change, it might become true again. The clause might become true. The question is, which one are you going to change? For each of those variables, let's say if it's a five-size clause, only for five variables, you check the delta. And then pick the variable that has the highest delta and flip it. Okay. The difference between what I'm doing here and what I notionally described last time was amount of greediness. Are you going to look at all possible variables and see the best variable? Or are you going to look at just the variables that appear in one of the random clauses? Okay. And then having picked this, that greedy step, this is still a greedy step because you picked the variable that is best in some sense. Then you have a coin which comes heads with probability p and tails with probability 1 minus p. You toss it. And if it does come heads, you will actually flip that particular variable. If it comes tails, then you will pick any other variable from that clause and flip it. Randomly pick any other variable from that clause and flip it. This is a version of min conflict local search. Okay, and in fact, and here is a little thing that's showing that if the clear, consider the assignment all false, okay, clauses 1 and 5 are definitely violated. If everything is false, then P, R, S, R, U is still false, and similarly R or S is also false, okay. Suppose I randomly pick 5, because one of the guys who dead, now they need to be, everybody has to become true, so suppose I work on this. Now I need to either shift R, flip R, or flip S. Okay. So then, if I flip R, one constraint still remains violated. Whereas if I flip S, 4 and 6 and 7 will still remain violated. So it looks like flipping R is greedily a better thing to do. Okay. So the greedy thing is to flip R. We will get everything is false except R, which is going to be true. Okay. Otherwise, pick either of them randomly. Now, having gotten this new assignment, check if all the clauses are satisfied. In fact, the clauses are not all yet satisfied because we do know that one still is violated. So you do this further. And the difference, the point about max flips is after some number of these iterations, you come out and declare failure. Okay? Within those iterations, you are actually doing probabilistic hill climbing. That means you're not always doing the greedy thing, you're doing greedy thing with probability p. Now this is a simple algorithm for finding models for a propositional knowledge base, right? And it works. And in fact, as I pointed out earlier, this is one of the, for the longest time, for a while in the middle, these sort of very simple local search algorithms were the fastest ways to solve large scale satisfiability problems. So this is actually one of our heroes. Keep this in mind when we start looking at entailment and see whether we can use this to compute entailment. Because I sort of mentioned to you that entailment has something to do with models. Okay, entailment has something to do with solution of a CSP problem. So we'll see, we'll now look at that more formally. Okay, so that's, think of that as a sort of review of what we did last class, so that we'll all come back to the same page. Before I go with the main lecture, which is the knowledge representation with propositional logic, what happened to the project? Everybody's done? Good. Okay. So make sure that you give them by the end of the class. Okay. Yes. No, it's just a number. It's a patience factor. how long are you going to wait for a solution? So if I say 1,000, that means I'm going to flip 1,000 times. And if I didn't find a solution during those 1,000 times, I'll give up. In fact, I could have changed it a little bit and said, I could put max flips, and then after the max flips, rather than say I'm dead, you can put another, one more counter on top, which is essentially random restart. So after the max flips, so you start with, if you started with the solution that the procedure you were looking at, you started with a random assignment and you kept searching in its neighborhood, in essence, by hill climbing, probabilistic hill climbing. If it was completely greedy hill climbing, you're going to be very likely getting stuck in local minima. With that probabilistic component, you're not as likely to get stuck in local minima. Another way of not getting stuck in local minima is to forget about the P factor, always do the greedy thing, but then put an extra counter and extra loop on top, saying after about 1,000 flips, if I didn't come out with a successful solution, I get out of the inner loop, go to the outer loop, generate a completely new random assignment. Now, this is actually possible, in fact, because you can always generate a random assignment. But this is sort of like applied to actual execution. Applied to actual execution of, you know, climbing a hill, this is a pretty painful thing to do. So what I'm saying is, after every 2 hours, magically transport yourself to a completely random position and start climbing again. How do you do it? For a search, it's not a big deal. For a search, it just has to generate a random assignment. For an execution, this is not actually a nice thing to do. So, and in fact, not surprisingly, people actually have pointed out that the version that I showed you, I believe it's called WalkSat. There are many, many variants of this where all the variations are very minor. Okay, in terms of, for example, how is the probability parameter changed? How is the variable that you're going to flip picked? Is it flipped from, you know, picked from one of the failing clauses? Are from all the variables, for example. Okay, so this is called WalkSat. The version that you saw on the board earlier was called WalkSat algorithm, and it's been shown to be better in general than a satisfiability algorithm based purely on random restart. So that's why WalkSat actually has stayed around much longer. But I did mention in the last class, while we were getting done, that despite the fact that local search algorithms are very fast, the satisfiability competitions currently, the winners of the satisfiability competitions are all systematic searchers. Okay? So you have to keep that in mind. So there's something else happened after this. Furthermore, in today's class itself, we'll find that if what you are doing is inference rather than finding solutions, finding a model, local search doesn't help. Actually, you can understand this now, even before I go into the details. What's the difference between, what are some of the differences between local search and systematic search? In a local search algorithm, if there's a solution, you are likely to find it, Okay, suppose I give you a problem for which there is no solution. How does a local search algorithm figure that out? It will not. Okay, if I have any property that would depend upon the set of all solutions, not the existence of a single solution, but on the set of all solutions. Okay, for example, I want to count the number of solutions for a CSP problem, or I want to prove that the set of all solutions is an empty set. In those cases, local search won't work as well. Now the funny part is entailment, you'll see, is deeply connected to proving that a knowledge base has no, that a particular propositional knowledge base has no solution. In fact, I can point this out now itself. Suppose, and I already showed this funny sign. I'm going in somewhat of a cyclic fashion, but I think it'll be easy enough to understand by the time we're done. Suppose I have, you know, P and Q, and P implies Q. And so P implies R, right? And Q implies J, and R and J imply M. You guys understand this, right? This is not that hard. I mean, you don't need to, I mean, you have thought about propositional logic before. So in this kind of a scenario, what I want to do is, I want to ask, is M entailed? Is M true? Given I know all these things, is M true? You all know that M is true. I need an automated procedure to find this. Okay? One way of finding it is the following. It turns out that if M is true whenever this is true, this is what you want to prove. Prove by contradiction. Let's assume M is false and add it to the database and see if you can find a model such that all of these guys are true, I mean, such that basically everything is true, which means including this, all the clauses are true, which actually means that M is false. If you can't find a model, then it must be the case that M was true. Do you understand what I'm saying? We'll say this again, but in essence, proof is showing, I mean, if you want to prove something, assume its negation, add it to your CSP problem, in the propositional CSP problem, and try to prove that there is no solution to this CSP problem. If there was no solution for the CSP problem, then it turns out that the original thing must have been true. Okay, so entailment is now connected to finding solutions of CSP problems. It looks like it's a solved problem because we just looked at how to solve CSP problems. What's the catch? The catch is you can't use local search, for example. You have to use a systematic search. Why can't you use a local search? Because a local search is extremely good at finding a solution if the problem has solution. You know, if it will never be able to prove to you that there are no solutions, because to prove that there are no solutions, you essentially have to exhaust the search space. Local search can never do that. Okay? Yes, sir?
Why can't we set M equal to true and use local search and find a solution?
Then what happens?
Then we have shown that M can be true and there can be
M true. M can be true is different from M will be true. See, the point about proof, this is a very good question, and we will come back to this in the real class, okay? The point is, saying that M can be true essentially means believing in M is not inconsistent with believing all these things. Just because something is not inconsistent doesn't mean it actually follows. Do you understand what I'm saying? So here, if I have the propositional database P, okay, it is, by your thing, I can say, well, Q is consistent. You can believe in P as well as Q. There's nothing wrong because I can find a model. Okay, whereas, you know, so, but P does not entail Q. In every world where P is true, Q is not true. The entailment is whenever your knowledge base is true, in that world, this is also true. That's the thing that we are interested in finding. I'm not completely downplaying the consistency issue. The question, of course, about consistency is, if you suddenly, in fact, the consistency one winds up being useful in the following sense. Suppose you came up with a hypothesis as to how the world is working. Okay. Now, you might want to at least check if that hypothesis is consistent with the rest of what you know about how the world is working. In that case, you look for consistency. But more often than not, what you're looking for is, given what I know about the world, is the following fact true? Can I prove it, deductively? And there, you have to, if it must be true whenever your knowledge base is true, then the only way you prove this is, take the negation of it, add it to the database, and if you can say that there is no solution, then you have proved it. Okay. So having said all this, let's go through the more formal way into getting to knowledge representation. In general, you have, you know, your agent is going to write whatever it knows into a knowledge base. And then, presumably, it would ask a question, given all the sentences that I know, is the following sentence true? That's the most useful question. There are other questions, such as the one you said. Is, given all I know, is it okay to believe this other sentence? That means, is it inconsistent with what I believe in? Okay. But more than the most fundamental question is, given what I know, is this true? Is this also holding? So if I believe what I believe, this must also be true. Okay? that's what you're, and you're trying to compute this automatically. So you need some kind of a knowledge, a representation language in which you write your knowledge base, and you need some kind of an algorithm that works on these, you know, knowledge, these sentences, and checks whether a new sentence holds given what you know. That's what a knowledge, basic knowledge representation is all about. Okay, and if you have such a thing, an intelligent agent of the kind that we were looking at in the beginning of the semester could essentially keep writing what it learnt about the world into its knowledge base. It already started with some sort of a knowledge base with, let's say, all the propositional sentences that it knows, for example, and it adds more things, and then it can ask, given what I know, is the following thing true? Is the right thing to do is action A5? And if the knowledge base, if in fact A5 is the right action, then the knowledge base will say, yes, the right thing to do given what you know is to do action A5. And then you can do action A5. Since after all that an agent is supposed to figure out is what to do next, this would be a way of going about it. Okay? Now, of course, you need to represent, to do this, you have to have a representation and you have to reason with it. Now, in general, any kind of a representation with a reasoning mechanism connected with it is called a logic. Okay, but then it is a specific kind of logic that we all are probably familiar with, that is propositional and first order logics, you know, which are deterministic ones. But in general, actually, any formal representation mechanism for which there is an inference procedure can be thought of as a logic. Okay, so for example, and a logic in general has two important things. One is syntax, which is a way to write the sentences such that they are grammatically correct in that language, and semantics, which is what are these sentences representing. Okay, so syntax you already know propositional logic is one. So there is syntax for propositional logic. You have propositions and you have connectives. Okay, so for example, I can write propositions. This is a grammatically correct sentence, whereas this is not, because Q and what? You can't put the connective without the other thing. Okay, and similarly, you can't do this, but you can do this. This is syntax. Okay, and similarly, x plus 2 greater than or equal to y is a sentence, whereas x 2 plus y greater than is not a sentence in a mathematical representation language. Okay, so that's basically the syntax part. The semantics part is essentially you have to first describe a set of possible worlds. Okay, and then talk about all those, among those possible worlds, what are the worlds where this sentence holds true. Think of any sentence, and in fact, thinking of it this way is actually quite easy, having thought about constraint satisfaction algorithms. What is a constraint in constraint satisfaction algorithm? A constraint essentially is saying, you know, if I say, if x equal to 2, y must be 7, suppose that constraint said that. What is it in essence saying? Suppose there are a total of x, y, z, w variables, 4 variables. The possible worlds, and assume that they have, let's say, true, false. I mean, if x equal to true, y equal to false, let's say. So, if they're all Boolean variables, there are 2^4 possible worlds. This constraint is saying, adding this constraint says, the world that I live in cannot be all those 16 worlds. It's only a subset of them. The more you know, the more constraints you know, the more you know about the actual world you are living in. Okay? If you think of your world being defined in n Boolean variables, if your knowledge base is empty, then you think you are in 1^2 n possible worlds. Okay? And if your knowledge base just says variable 1 is true, then you know now that you are in 1^(n-1) worlds. Adding knowledge reduces the uncertainty about what worlds you actually are in. That's one way of thinking about it. So in fact, you can say that for each of these sentences, the semantics, loosely speaking, from a propositional logic, in a logic you call the constraints, what we call constraints in CSP get called sentences from a logical point of view. Okay? And the semantics of a sentence is that a sentence is a set of possible worlds that are actually feasible. Okay, if you believe in this sentence, only these possible worlds are feasible. So if I give you two sentences, what do I mean? This sentence must hold, this sentence also must hold. So for example, in my n variable scenario, I had n Boolean variables describing my state, and I said first variable is true, you suddenly know that there are only two powers. So if I said x1 is true, this corresponds to 2 power n minus 1 worlds, okay, which basically start by x1 equal to true, blah, 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 blah. Now if I add another sentence saying x2 equal to false to my knowledge base, this corresponds to a different set of 2 power n minus 1 worlds, which are of the form, I don't care what happens to x1, x1 can be anything, and x2 is false, then blah, blah, blah. Now if both of these are present in your knowledge base, that means you believe this as well as this. That means the possible worlds you are in must be an what of these two sets? Intersection. That's all. As your knowledge increases, you are essentially intersecting the possible worlds of the individual sentences. Okay? Now my question, of course, is suppose if I were to ask, you know, if I have these kinds of knowledge bases, suppose if I were to ask, given this, let's say, suppose these are the two things that you know, okay? Is it true that at least x1 is true or x2 is false in the world you live in? Is it true? I can check that because I can see the possible worlds where that correspond to this sentence. The sentence that I'm trying to prove, it's a constraint itself. It has a set of the worlds. Okay? So let that set of worlds be this. These are all the worlds that correspond to this. If I can basically show that the worlds represented by this blue thing is what? Super or subset? The worlds represented by this, as long as they are a subset of the worlds where this sentence is true, then you know that whatever you know, it's one of these blue things. But the blue thing as a whole is a subset of the red thing. So you know that in the worlds you live in, this constraint must already be satisfied. That's what you do in proving sentences. From a model theoretic point of view, you are essentially trying to prove, so as you add more sentences to your knowledge base, you are taking intersections between their possible worlds. So the worlds corresponding that are consistent with your knowledge base are the intersections of the sets of worlds corresponding to individual sentences. Okay? And to prove that a new sentence always holds in your knowledge base, all you need to prove is that in every world which is consistent with your entire knowledge base, this sentence is also true. This sentence can be true outside of it too. I don't care about that. All I need is whenever this is true. Okay? So that's the picture that we will see in a minute. So entailment, what I just showed you is entailment. And in fact, if you are into logic, this is like the most important notion. Okay, which is, given a knowledge base, can I prove that another sentence, a knowledge base is a collection of sentences, can I then prove that a new sentence alpha is entailed? What I mean by that is, if every model of the knowledge base is also a model of alpha, which is exactly what I said here. A model essentially is a possible world where the knowledge base is true. If every model of the knowledge base is also a model of alpha, then it is entailed. This is essentially what you do in trying to prove things in logic. Okay? And you know, here is the picture that we just drew. Okay, the way you prove that alpha is entailed by the knowledge base is you consider all the possible worlds in which the knowledge base is true, which is the set of models of the knowledge base, and prove to yourself that it is a proper subset of the set of worlds where alpha is true. And this is all easy if you think of sentences as just shorthand notations for sets of worlds. Whenever I tell you a piece of knowledge, I'm cutting down the set of possibilities of the world that you can live in. Think of knowledge as constraints. I mean, we tend to think of knowledge as freeing and all that nonsense, but really it's constraints. Okay? The guy who has no knowledge is ignorant and proud of it, because you know, he thinks or she thinks that in an n boolean variable world, I could be any one of the 2 power n. But not in, you know, the more and more you know about the real world you live in, it's going to be smaller and smaller subset of that 2 power n. Okay, so knowledge is actually constraining the reality that you live in. Okay, so anyway, so that's basically entailment. Okay, now the question, of course, is I just showed you how to do entailment. It's a set theoretic check. Okay, how do you do it actually by a computer program? You can do it computer program wise if you can do a subset check. But to do subset check, it better be the case that the sets are finite. If they are infinitely large, then it's a bit of a problem. Okay? So, and it turns out that for simple logics, actually, for simple logics, the number of possible worlds is always finite. For propositional logic in particular, if you have a propositional logic with n propositions, the number of possible worlds is 2 power n. And we'll see pretty soon that when we get into things like first order logic, that once you have first order logic with function symbols, essentially the number of possible worlds is infinite. Okay? You can talk about subsets and supersets over infinite sets, but you don't want to check it. Without, you know, the way you normally check subset and superset in infinite sets is by mathematical induction. Okay, so now you may want to have other possible ways of doing these proofs. So there is, so if you actually directly prove the entailment by looking at the models, the sets of models, and proving that the set of models of the knowledge base is a subset of the set of models of what you're trying to prove, then you would say you have proved it using model theory. Okay, so that's model checking based proof. An alternate way is to do inference rules. Okay, so what basically is, that's the kind of thing that you all know and love. The inference thing essentially says, here are a bunch of syntactic patterns that hold. So for example, you know the following pattern. If P is true and P implies Q is true, you get to always write Q. Okay, this is an inference pattern, and this pattern has a name. What was the name of this? It's called modus ponens, or you know, many of you may just think of as the implication rule. Okay, there is another kind of an implication rule. If not Q is true and P implies Q is true, then what can I say? Not P is true. And this is called modus tollens. And there is a third kind of a rule. If Q is true and P implies Q is true, then P is true. What is that rule called? That's called the Monty Python rule. Okay. Right. So if Q is true, P implies Q is true, P is true, this is a nice looking inference rule. What's wrong with it? What's wrong with it is that an inference rule has to be sound and, at least it has to be sound. Okay? And this rule is not sound. Just because Q is true doesn't mean P made Q true. And, you know, the beautiful sequence of logical assertions that they have found, where if it's a witch, it must be made of wood, so it should be floating on water, so we should put her on a, you know, thing and compare it to a duck. I mean, that's a beautiful sequence of inferences of this form. So this is the Python inference. Okay, Python inference unfortunately is funny but not sound. The question, of course, is how do you say, so what's wrong with it? What is wrong with it is, for every inference rule, you need it to be sound. That's what you guys said. Some of you said, what is sound? What is sound is the following. The boss is model checking. If any time the inference rule lets you prove that a sentence P is true, you can also show that the model checking would have let you prove that the sentence P is true, then that inference is a sound rule. Do you understand what I'm saying? So for example, you know, the TA is an easy way, for example, to understand what I might be teaching you. And I would say the TA is a sound TA if whenever he says the answer to problem one is this, and if you took the time to come to my room and figured it out, I would still say the same thing. Then the TA, I'm the boss, so the TA is sound with respect to me. Okay, now what about TA being complete? If you went to the TA and said, how about this particular problem? He said, I don't know, go talk to Rao. Okay, then the TA is incomplete. Our TA is, of course, very complete, but, you know, in that particular case, the TA would be incomplete. Okay, why is he or she incomplete? Because the proof, it could have been proved to be true or false. So, for example, you asked, you know, is the answer to this question this? And the TA said, go talk to Rao. Then the TA, seen as an inference rule, is incomplete because he's saying, I don't know, maybe it's true, go check with him. Okay, so soundness means whenever you say that the sentence is true, sentence is inferred, then it is also entailed according to the model check. Now the alternate point is completeness. Completeness means everything that is entailed is actually inferred. In propositional logic, you know a large number of inference rules that are sound. Modus tollens is sound. Modus ponens is sound. Do we know any inference rules, elementary inference rules, that are both sound and complete? Turns out you don't. Okay, so for example, the simplest case that we'll see in a minute, maybe we can see it now, is, I'll come back to this in a minute. Oh my God. No, okay, that's a very good question. So here is the interesting thing. So if, what would be a good inference rule? So if you have soundness, you have defined two properties, soundness and completeness. What should you be looking for? Just sound, just complete? Are both sound and complete, or neither sound nor complete? What's our quest? What's our holy grail here? It has to be sound and complete. So what we really look for is sound and complete inference procedure. But suppose we are dumb, we don't have the time, you know, to find both sound and complete procedure. You have to give up on one of them. Which would you rather give up? That's a question. That's a good question, actually. In fact, most of the time, we would say we will give up on completeness and we will be sound. But you can think of scenarios where you might want to give up on soundness and or just use completeness. It all is a question of how, which bounds you want. Okay. But most, the normal answer is, if you were to give completeness or soundness up, you would much rather give up completeness than give up soundness. Okay? So, but I can come up with a inference rule which is definitely complete, but is not sound. But maybe not sound. Okay? Which is, you come and ask me any question, ask me. I'll say, yeah. Is Q implied by what you know? Yeah, sure. How about P? Yeah, that's true. How about not Q? Yeah, fine. I'm complete, because anything you can prove using boss, I can prove too. Okay? But the problem is I'm proving way more than my boss can prove. Okay, so in fact, if you are asking yourself, if you are to give up completeness or soundness, let's say, is it harder to, it's clear that finding a sound and complete inference rule must be hard. The question is, if I'm just looking for sound inference rule or complete inference rule, which is easier to write? Complete inference rule is a no-brainer. Just keep saying yes, and that's complete. Okay, how do you get trivially sound inference rules? Don't open your mouth the way you do in the class. You just keep quiet, because by mistake, if you open your mouth, you can be wrong. So just keep your mouth shut. And that's trivially sound. Because if you never say anything, right, how could you be wrong? Right? So it is easy to get trivially sound rules. It is easy to get trivially complete rules. What we want are things which are close to complete and sound. Okay? Yeah, I think, yes, there are lots of interesting connections in terms of bounds too, in terms of upper and lower bounds. But let's... Where am I? Okay. Ew, that's not good. It doesn't like me somehow. Okay. So this is where we were. Now we were doing this, in some sense I'm thinking of this proof method without actually sticking to a specific language, but I was also playing this game of using propositional logic as an example to illustrate this point. Okay? But and then this is the soundness and completeness that we already discussed. You can read this. And in fact, all this says is an inference rule I is sound if whenever the knowledge base, whenever the inference rule allows you to infer alpha, the knowledge base actually entails alpha. Okay. Normally, by the way, these signs, this is called derives, and this is called entails. Entail is basically what the model theory will tell you. So that's the bar. Okay? An inference rule, whatever an inference rule syntactically allows you to write, you normally call that a derivation. Okay? And a inference rule is sound if what it derives is definitely entailed. And it's complete if everything entailed is derivable. Okay? And as I said, it's trivial to find sound but not complete rules, and it's also trivial to find complete but not sound rules. And most useful rules that you know, such as modus tollens, modus ponens, are sound but not complete. Now, how did I say they're sound but not complete? An example, in fact, is the following. And in fact, I'll write it here now. Example is the following, which is, if P, then J. If R, then J. Either P or R is true. My question is J true?
Yes.
You guys can see it is true. Tell me how you can use modus ponens or modus tollens or any of these rules to figure that out. Any single rule is not going to be able to tell you, right? Because I cannot use modus ponens, for example, because there is nothing about P. I only have P or R. Okay. Normally, the way you will get completeness is you get a bunch of sound rules and use them all together. Okay, but my one question would be, is there a single simple rule which by itself is both sound and complete? So in this particular case, the reason actually it winds up being hard to prove this is you need case analysis. because you have disjunction. P or R is true. Okay? So assume that I'm trying to prove if J is true. I can prove, assume the world is, you know, in which P is true and try to prove J. And assume the world where R is true, try to prove J. If you proved it in both cases, then you proved P. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you have to do case analysis. For the case where P is true, can you prove it? And for the case where R is true, can you prove it? If you can prove it in both cases, then you have proved it. Okay? And modest tolerance and modest ponderance are not good for that. Okay? On the other hand, one of the interesting things actually is whenever you have case analysis, you're doing a lot more combinations. You're checking, you know, intuitively speaking, you're checking over a lot more combinations. Okay? And you should not be surprised to find that running modest ponens to completion on any database or running modest ponens to completion on any database is polynomial time. That means just use modest ponens to derive everything that you can derive. That can be done in polynomial time. It turns out that given a propositional database, checking everything that can be derived, I mean that can be entailed, is actually not polynomial because it's connected to the models. Remember, the we'll see it in a minute, but basically it's connected to models to prove that M is entailed by a set of propositional sentences. You should be able to take M, negate it, add it to this side, and now prove that there are no models. So it's connected to satisfiability. It's actually conjugate of satisfiability. Satisfiability says show that there is a model. And you know, showing a model, what's the complexity of showing a model for satisfiability? That's NP complete. To show that there is no model, that's the conjugate of it, it's co-NP complete. Basically, it's also expected to be non-polynomial. Okay? So you kind of know, even from the dimensional analysis, that since modest ponens can be run to completion in linear, you know, in polynomial time, and since entailment is co-NP complete, there must be something between modest ponens and entailment, because you should not be, if you are actually able to entail, you know, compute entailment with a polynomial procedure, it should be a polynomial complexity to begin with. And it turns out that the full, in fact, if you do this case analysis, then you will get to non-polynomial. It looks as if I'm being masochist. I want my inference to be harder. But there is no free lunch. If, in fact, entailment was co-NP complete to begin with, I couldn't have been getting all entailment in polynomial time. I must be missing something. Okay. So, anyway, any questions? Yes. So if you do that, can you prove this, is what you're saying? Yes. In general, what's interesting is that you can use all the simple rules that you know, as well as the logical simplification, together to prove everything that is entailed. Okay? That much is easy. But it turns out there's a single rule called resolution, which actually is enough. Okay, since I'm doing everything in the, you know, circular fashion, let me complete that right now itself. The resolution rule essentially says the following thing. If you have a sentence, I'll do it right in terms of A, B, C. If I have a sentence saying A or B, and I have a sentence saying not B or C, okay, I can essentially take these two guys out and write A, R, C. That's resolution rule. I now posit to you that this is sound, and you should be able to check this. In fact, in a minute we will see how to prove rule sound. Basically, you can prove it by showing that anything they derive is in fact entailed. Okay? And showing that it's complete is actually trickier because you need to do induction. Okay, because everything that is entailed, there must be a way of deriving it using a series of these kinds of inferences. This particular inference rule is called resolution. And resolution actually is a superset of everything else you know. Okay? I would say that if you, and so first of all, let's see whether that will help here. Does that help here? This one, notice that it's already in the clausal form, so I need to put these guys in the clausal form. So P implies J is not P or J. And R implies J is not R or J. And then P or R. Okay? I can resolve these two over the not P and I will get J or R. I can resolve over this, okay, and R and not R will cancel out and I will get J or J. At this point, I will say I have proved it because J or J is J. And if you are not completely asleep, you should say that's not reasonable because you said you will only use one rule, not any more rules, okay. You are just going to use resolution and nothing else. But up until this, I got you, and then I said, oh, by the way, there is a logical equivalence called JRJ is J, and I'm going to use it now. That's not fair, actually, because that means I'm actually going to use logical, you know, simplifications in other places. It turns out that you can deal with this problem if you were to use resolution in a refutation fashion. What does it mean to say refutation fashion? If you want to prove J, add not J to the database and try to derive an empty clause. An empty clause essentially means false. And if you can derive empty clause, then you have proved that J was actually true. So in that case, what happens? Not P or J, not R R J, P R R, and not J. Okay? These two, I'll get a not R. These two, I'll get a not P. I'm sorry, P. Those two, I get a J. Those two, I get an empty clause. Now, you cannot, I mean, I hope you understand that if I knew not J was true at some point of time during the proof tree, it didn't disappear. If in my world, I figured out not J is true, and I'm doing more reasoning, not J did not go away. It's still there. So it's reasonable to actually use it multiple times. It's just the same, you can actually use the same fact in multiple resolutions. If I did it this way, in fact, I do not need to do any other rules. If I use resolution in the refutation format, I did not have to do the simplification. I did not have to use logical equivalences. Okay, I didn't prove that it's complete. All I showed you here is this rule was able to do something that modest ponens and modest tollens by themselves weren't able to do. Okay, and you can also easily prove to yourself that in fact resolution rule is a general form of modest ponens and modest tollens. Okay, so for example, a modest ponens will say P implies Q, P will give you Q. Now what would resolution say? P, not P or Q, will give me Q. Okay, what about modest tollens? It will say P implies Q, not Q, will give me not P. What will resolution say? Not P or Q, not Q, not P. Q true. It works and it's actually complete. In fact, what's interesting is propositional resolution itself actually, I mean logic was known, propositional logic was known, as you guys know, since the time of Greeks, ancient Greeks. But resolution rules are much, much later. Propositional resolution rule and its completeness, I don't quite remember, but It came much later. And the first order logic's resolution rule and its completeness, that proof happened in 1962. Given that first order logic and propositional logic existed for God knows how long, it's very interesting to know that the sound and complete inference, I mean that the proof that first order resolution, which is actually looks almost like this, except it will start having variables, that it is sound and complete, was done only in 1962. Okay. Anyway, so we actually heard everything that is interesting about propositional logic. What we are going to do is, I'll probably end with this slide, and when we come back on Monday, I will go through some more details of, for example, showing, first of all, the soundness, how do you prove soundness and complete soundness in particular of inference rule by using the model theoretic inference, which is using entailment, okay? And then we'll also talk about systematic search procedures for model theoretic entailment computation. We already know local search procedures. We also know systematic search procedures because, in fact, anything that you did for CSP, which is most constrained variable, most constraining value, forward checking, all of those work. Except when you use that general idea, even though Boolean SAT, even though SAT is just a special case of CSP, most constrained variable is the variable which has the lowest number of live values left. If variables can have anywhere between 0 and 10, there is a large range of constrainedness. It can be 1, it can be 2, it can be 3, it can be 10 values. For Boolean variables, the only possibilities are you have 0 values left, in which case that branch is dead. One value left, in which case that branch should have that value, two values left, which is always true. So some of the heuristics that we know and loved last week are not as effective this week when you actually look at that problem. And it turns out that there's a beautiful procedure called Davis-Putnam procedure, which winds up using resolution rule to prove that intermediate nodes are inconsistent. Intermediate nodes are dead. Remember, forward checking tries to prove, for example, that a partial state must be, tries to prove that it is dead by showing that some variable's domain has become empty. Okay? One thing that you could do using resolution is during the search, if I have some partial assignment, P is true, Q is false, etc., that plus the KB, I can try to use the resolution rule to derive an empty class. If I use the resolution rule to derive an empty class there, then I have proved to myself that I get to go home and sleep because that particular node is dead. But using the complete resolution rule would take how much time? Exponential time. Because running resolution to resolution to completion on any database is going to take exponential amount of time. So instead, what you do is you do what's called unit propagation, unit resolution. What is unit resolution? Unit resolution is a resolution where at least one of the clauses, remember resolution has two clauses, at least one of the clauses is unit length. If you do that, then what happens? If you take, let's say, P or Q or J, and you resolve with not J, then that goes away and I have P or Q. So class length reduced. And if I'm lucky, after a while of these, the class becomes empty. And actually running unit resolution winds up being faster. It's polynomial time. But it is not complete. It won't prove everything that can be proved. But all I need is, during search, if I can quickly show that this node is dead, I don't have to do anything. If I could not quickly show it is dead, then I'll do some more search and try to quickly show that its children are dead. If not, I don't have to. If I don't have to do anything again. See, the beauty is you can combine the search and inference hand in hand. That's the yin and yang of search. Okay, and Davis-Putnam procedure winds up using unit resolution in place of forward checking. That's its beautiful idea. And there is one other simple idea that we can talk about, but that's a big idea, unit propagation. And we can talk about that as to how you can use that to do systematic solvers for SAT. Okay, we will end there. I think this basically, we'll get back to this will be the starting slide of next class, where I'll say propositional logic is just one simple logic in the spectrum of things.